You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
War, Solus, Sue. Report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek, The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is The Arsenal of Freedom. I'm Blair from Ontario, Canada.
I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska. Okay, and tonight we do have a special guest who is Medic 1849 in the forum. His name is Blair, as he mentioned. Blair, wanted to tell us a little bit about yourself and what you like about Star Trek and who you are.
Sure. Well, I live in Canada, just north of Toronto. I never was alive during the original series. However, I did watch it a lot in reruns growing up. And in around 1987, when TNG first started, I always tell the story. I actually hated TNG the first season. Didn't really watch it. I was still loyal to the original series. Was very upset that they replaced Kirk, Spock, and Scotty, and all those guys. So I just ignored watching Star Trek The Next Generation in the first season. I remember seeing clips of it, and I knew LeVar Burton was in it from reading Rainbow, as I grew up on that show as well. But I didn't watch it until the second season when I was over at a friend's house and we sat down and I begrudgingly watched it, and I watched the episode Times Squared and I fell in love with it from there. So I know I always comment on the forums and I always give season one a very, very low score. I'm not a season one hater. I like to classify myself as a season one struggler. I just find that the TNG went on to do so much and was such a good series that the first season is very hard to watch. And starting in the second season, it was a little hard to go back to the first season and catch up and see the difference of, you know, Worf and LaForge in different uniforms, Riker with a beard, you know, just stuff like that. So, yeah, and I've just fallen in love with Star Trek ever since. Pretty much have seen everything first run after that. And my favorite series is Deep Space Nine.
Okay, all right. And you told us before we started recording that you're a paramedic up in Canada?
Yes.
So, you know, what's funny is nobody knows this, but I at one time was a basic EMT.
Oh.
And the reason why I let the license lapse is because I never worked in the field. And I think an EMT that doesn't work in the field is more dangerous than somebody who's not even trained at all.
Yeah, you definitely have to keep your skills up. I've been a paramedic now for 15 years in Canada and have my advanced training and really love my job, and I will be doing that until I'm dead or retired, whichever comes first. So, but you definitely need to use your skills or you'll lose them.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so it's interesting that in this call we have a doctor, a paramedic, and a guy who used to be a basic EMT. Now it's just a... Oh, Lou. Okay, so let's see what... Okay.
So, but can we qualify that with that I'm not a proper doctor?
Oh, you are a doctor. Well, you're not a guy who prescribes medicine, but you're still a doctor. It's still a good thing. So, okay, let's see here. One of my favorite shows is the 1970s show Emergency. And Are you familiar with it?
I remember seeing them more in reruns, but yes, I am familiar with it.
Okay, so Johnny and Roy are racing to a heart attack victim who went into V-fib, and they counter shock 400 watt seconds. So, okay, you got him back, but he's bradycardia, I believe it's called, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what's the medicine of choice now?
What's a medicine of choice?
Yeah, well, to help increase the heart rate.
The standards change over time, but I would give atropine.
That's what they used to do too. All right. So now the difference of the two, and we'll get back to Star Trek in a second, but The difference between the 70s and today is you have standing orders where you know what you're supposed to give based on what you're reading. But back then, they actually had to have the doctor for everything, tell them what to do. They couldn't even start an IV until right. the doctor told them to do that. So
in Ontario, we have a combination. We still have our standing orders. However, there are certain standing orders that will indicate we will call the doctor and we will ask, we will paint the picture of what we want. Yeah. And then we will hope that the doctor gives us what we've asked for.
Right.
Sometimes they do. Sometimes they don't. So
right. And as a parent, what would irritate me, and this, you know, that show is based on real life. They have a child who's unconscious, fading, but they can't do anything without parental consent. And, you know, today, now that we have implied consent laws, you know, I want you to save my child. But it's amazing mm-hmm. back then that they didn't have that. But anyway, okay, love having you on the show there, Blair.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great.
Okay, so, Doc, unless you've got something else, let's go ahead and have Blair continue under the synopsis.
Please go ahead.
All righty.
All right, the synopsis for tonight's show is Geordi LaForge leads the Enterprise into battle while Captain Picard and an away team are trapped on the planet Minos, taking fire from a dangerous automated weapon system. This is the 21st episode of Season 1 of Star Trek The Next Generation. The original release date is April 11th, 1988. This episode was written by Maurice Hurley and Robert Lewin and directed by Les Landau. The stars include Vincent, I can't even say this word, Schiavelli?
I think it's Schiavelli. Schiavelli.
Yeah, they've got some really good ones tonight. as the Minosian peddler. Marco Rodriguez as Captain Paul Rice. Vito Ruganis as Lieutenant Logan. Julia Nixon as Ensign Leanne Sue. George De La Pena as Lieutenant Junior Grade Orville Solis. So, guys, what do we think about this episode? I know for myself, I love this episode. One of the few season one episodes that I love or that I like. What about you guys?
There's actually an interesting story about this episode in particular, because when I was watching the TNG on first run, there are only a few episodes that I remember. I think I probably saw more of them, but there are only a couple that kind of got highlighted. I've mentioned before that Code of Honor was my first. I do remember seeing When No One Has Gone Before on first run. And this is another one that sticks out as a big, a very, very clear memory on my original season one watch, which would have been when I was probably 10 or 11, something like that. And I actually really enjoyed it.
Okay.
What about you, Lou?
Yeah, I kind of enjoy it too. I like seeing Worf in a new position because Tasha was on the planet instead of being on the ship. And we also see Geordi in his increased role as well. And you all know I like Geordi, so it's fun keeping him on the bridge. So, yes, I am pretty good with this too. And as much as I want to talk about this episode, Doc wants to get into something else, so why don't you tell us what you wanted we should do, Doc?
I think we should visit the forums.
Yeah, I think so too. Okay. And we left off on When the Bow Breaks. And did you like the forum post? Rock-a-bye baby on the starship. When a planet appears, there will be hardship. When the bow breaks is the name of this ep. So download the show now. It won't be a schlep. Okay, yeah. Anyway. They're not laughing with me, guys. You know that, right? All right.
I'm just wondering why we didn't put that at the front of the episode.
You know, I really should have. But I didn't think of it till after it was edited and put up and yeah. So anyway, although I had to redo Home Soil today or yesterday because I realized when I listened to it after I uploaded it that it was distorted. I increased the audio too high. So I redid it. And so if anybody has a distorted version, you've got the rare version that got axed. Okay, let's start with Kira Macduff for When the Bow Breaks. It says, I think you nailed it again. Thank you. With suggestions that this has some good concepts, but they're not very well put together. Love the explanation of why you couldn't cloak a planet and keep it hidden all the way. As you said, we find distant planets now being able to see them. I hadn't even considered that the light wouldn't be able to the planet.
Wouldn't be able to reach the planet.
Reach the planet, is that what you said? Okay. And given inhabitants aren't used to bright lights, I'm surprised that never crossed my mind anyway. Nevertheless, having problems with technology you become dependent on is definitely a good morality story. Sadly, I'm not convinced this does a good job of convincing us that they're actually dependent on it. You can have babies if you stop hiding. Never mind the odd rumors about the planet. The truth is far more boring than the legend. When you stop hiding, you'll probably find no one is interested in your planet anyway. That, coupled with annoying child actors, makes this a pretty poor episode overall. I could see what they wanted to do, but I don't think they managed it very well. So yet again, I'm going with the glorious 2 out of 5. And most of that, too, purely for the overall concept. That came from Kieran McDuff, who then followed up with, P.S. I prefer watching TOS in production order. That was a discussion we had. That way, that was always the order I had them on VHS. I'm not old enough to have watched them at broadcast time anyway. And isn't that what you decided to do, was production order, yes, not air date? No,
it is. And by the way, the in England, at least, VHS were released in production order, and then the DVDs were released in air date order. So that is the thing that really annoys me. I think that they should just put them in production order, but that doesn't matter.
Okay, well, whatever.
Okay, shall I go on to Paul? So the Paul from previously Alpha Quadrant. This episode is pretty hideous, but you guys brought a new angle to this episode for me, as you both have children. I mean, I'm not entirely is that true? I mean, I suppose, Lou, you were very defensive of your children.
Oh, yeah.
But I think when I listened back, I was less defensive for some reason. I don't know why. Thanks for once again for a great review. P.S. Imagine if Neelix got the run of the Enterprise D with all the kids. Field day.
You know, I want to talk about that because Paul, I'm not exactly sure what he means by that. That could be taken in I think, a couple different ways. And I'm not exactly sure what he's trying to say. Do you think Naomi Wildman was like a potential victim to a predator, or do you think maybe because he's like a kid at heart that he wouldn't want to play on the holodeck with the kids all day? I don't know what that's supposed to mean.
It's the former.
The former? What do you mean the former?
It's the predator part.
You think so?
I am. Well, we should invite him on and ask him.
You know, that's an interesting question. I think we should. Are you talking about Paul or Ethan? Ethan, tell me about your role as Neelix. Do you think maybe you were some, like, child predator or something on the ship? Yeah, we'll hear him click.
Hey, I met Ethan Phillips, and I happened to have my daughter with me that day when I met him. And he was very kind to her, and he remembered her name even, for crying out loud, because we got his autograph earlier, and he was very kind. So I'd like to give him the benefit of the doubt, but, you know. But I held on to my daughter's hand just in case.
Give me a hug. No. Stranger danger. Okay. Anyway. Oh, and what you said about, you know, us having children, I think that goes into what Queen Cat Blue went into as well, too. Thank you for a very entertaining podcast. I really enjoy the interaction between the two of you. Like Lou says, I can't imagine not doing everything within my power to get back my child if she were kidnapped. How long would we sit in orbit around that planet to get them back, even if they had cloaked? I would have spent the rest of my life, unless I knew the child was dead, I would completely just keep going. But anyway, I actually want to come out on an idea that you tossed out, James, into the mix about art and nature of art. Do you want to finish that?
What is she... Yeah, I am really sorry about this. Because I was listening back and I'm thinking, oh dear, this is me, A, going off on a tangent, but also me going off on a tangent and not, without really thinking about anything. And apparently, I think it's a fascinating point that you make art that isn't just about the talent that a person has or doesn't have. It is about the technology and the media that is available to the artist or architect or artisan at the time that the art was produced. I immediately started thinking about all of the Gothic cathedrals that were built in the late Middle Ages. They are beautiful, soaring works of art that were able to be constructed by master architects and masons because the technology had progressed to the point where the walls could be supported by the flying buttresses. Is that right? Buttresses, and thus rendering the need for thick walls obsolete. Another example are the cave paintings throughout Europe, like Lascaux and Niao, with prehistoric cave drawings which used the technology of the day not only to paint and etch the animals into the walls, but also help prehistoric man access the deepest parts of the caves in order to paint the animals, rendered fat for candles. Anyway, I will stop rambling, but again, it was an interesting point that was brought up by James. Thanks for stimulating my little grey cells. Oh, and I do apologize for not giving a rating for this episode, as I haven't watched it in years. However, I give the podcast a 5. So that's nice. Very nice of Cena.
Okay. And
By the way, Lou, you should get yourself a button that has like a Picard-style "Shut up, Wesley." But it should be "Shut up, James." And whenever I go off on these tangents and I start talking to you about the importance of instruments, "Shut up, James! Shut up, James!
Quiet, number one." That's it.
We need one of those.
"Quiet, number one. I'll toss him number two at you." Okay, let's talk about the Arsenal of Freedom. Do you think, James, we should possibly count the number of times and have a running total of the number of times Wrecker's offered a promotion and turns it down?
Yes, no, absolutely. Although I'm under the impression, I don't know if this is true, because I don't think I've ever checked, I've just heard. Aren't most of the ships that he's offered the promotion on, aren't they destroyed at Wolf 359?
Well, yeah. And so is the Drake.
Because I was under the impression that they specifically mention that, because he was offered the Melbourne at one point, yes. And mm-hmm. whatever it was, but I think at least two of them that are mentioned, they were, you know, they would have been potentially Riker's ships.
Yep. One was the Kyushu, the Melbourne, and there was another one, but I don't remember the first one.
"We are now approaching the Wolf system, Captain."
"On my way." "Slow to impulse. Take us to the battle coordinates, Mr. Crusher. Yellow alert."
"Sensors are picking up several vessels, Captain."
"The fleet?"
"No active subspace fields. Negligible power readings."
"Life signs?"
"Negative, sir."
"Visual contact?"
"On screen."
Tolstoy, the Kyushu, the Melbourne."
But anyway, yeah, that was what's her name that did that. But yeah, I mean, he must be thinking twice now, at least that we could think of. Thank God I didn't take that promotion. And besides, okay, he's offered the Drake and turns it down, so Paul Rice is given command. And of course, the entire crew of the Drake is presumed dead. Would Riker have been able to figure out the puzzle and save the crew, do you think?
No. No, I don't think so.
No?
I don't think so. Because I don't think he does much in this episode at all, does he?
No, the only reason the only reason they solved the puzzle is because they fell down a hole. Crusher and Picard. Okay, plus, here's another thing. The Drake's top speed is warp 3.
I noticed that too.
Well, I thought about that. Was it actually the Drake the guy was referring to, or was it that weapon? Was the weapon's top speed warp 3? Because initially I thought he was referring to the Drake, but afterwards I was thinking, well, did they mean that the top, his armaments, or hit the actual weapon itself's top speed was a warp 3?
No, I firmly believe that he was pretending to be Drake, Rice. He wanted to fool Riker to give, you know, in an attempt to get information. So yes, he would have given him the real information. Our top speed is warp 3. If it was warp 7, I think Riker would have known that, because obviously he was offered the Drake. Mm-hmm. You know, would you like to be the captain of the Drake? Its top speed is warp 7. It's this class starship. No, I don't want that. I want to be on the Enterprise. So if Rice was to say our top speed is warp 3, Riker would say, no, it isn't. So right. I got a feeling exactly that.
Okay. And then it's a pretty slow ship. A warp 3, oh my.
I mean, by the way, I tend to side with Blair on this. I do. I especially when you look at him, he's been very kind of dodgy, you know, this hologram of Rice. And I don't think he could, the ship couldn't possibly be warp 3, right? That would be ridiculous. But you can just imagine, let's assume for a second that it was. So Riker has, you know, two job offers. He has a job offer to go onto the flagship and, you know, work under Picard and, you know, perhaps hang around for a while, hope that Picard gets injured on an away team mission and take over. Oh. Or he has a warp 3 ship, which is slower than, like, it's like 400 years in the past in terms of technology. I mean, it sounds like he made the good call, good move anyway, to get onto the Enterprise.
Well, yeah. That's what I was thinking, too. I mean, would you want to be the captain of a slow ship where you're barely going anywhere? Or first officer of the flagship? I'll take the flagship. Are there any holodecks on the Drake? You know, does Riker have his girls playing the harp thing on the Drake? I don't know. Okay. So what do you think about LaForge and his one-liners in this episode?
I like them. Yeah, I just found LaForge in the first season was almost like he was a junior officer, but a young junior officer. The minute he gets that promotion to chief engineer, he's a much more mature LaForge. I definitely think there's a difference between the two LaForges. And I'm okay with the young LaForge, the young officer, not fresh out of the academy, but only maybe been in 5 or 6 years and that. So.
Right, and you know something? I think this is something that the Doctor and I kind of disagree on. I think LaForge was obviously put in the command chair, and Worf was put in the tactical position because they knew that these two would be doing different roles in the future. And so they wanted to start showing them and shining them and making people think, hey, he's pretty good. I mean, what do you think of that, Blair?
Well, I wonder if they knew Worf or Denise Crosby was on her way out. So I agree with the Worf. LaForge, I'm not really sure if they really knew what they were going to do with him initially. It's almost like a Tom Paris, you know, Tom Paris, the pilot. Mm-hmm. There's only so much you can do as a pilot. But I think in Voyager, they really developed Tom Paris and gave him other, you know, other attributes and other things to do. I just don't know. I think this was a way of, hey, let's see what, you know, let's see how LaForge could handle it. But we still have Data, Riker. We still have too many people way above him to really waste his character sitting piloting. And heck, we can bring Wesley in to do that. And so I don't know. I just get the impression they really weren't sure what they wanted to do with LaForge in the first season.
Right. Speaking of which, later in my notes, I make a very interesting observation of where the heck is Wesley today?
Yeah.
His mother's down on this planet, and they can't get them back. Where's Wesley? He's not trying to save the ship today. So,
no, I mean, he's not in the episode, right? So he is clearly missing.
Yeah.
Perhaps he's at school today.
Ah. Yep, that's right. Heavy on study. Those were the words that Picard said. Okay, anyway, so yeah, that's a heck of a sales pitch or a dissatisfied customer. I kind of like LaForge in this one.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, now here's an interesting thing. When the away team, which Tasha cuts down to a minimum, enters a turbo lift, did you guys notice Picard is looking at them as the door is closing, but when the door closes, he continues to look? You know, kind of like with a little partial smile or maybe a smirk until the camera turns off. So I was thinking, you know, could we come up with a few things that he was thinking or what was he looking at? You know, perhaps he's feeling bad that Riker turned down that promotion to take the first officer gig. So if you were to think quickly, what are some of the things going through Picard's head as he looked at the doors of the turbo lift after they closed?
I mean, I think he's thinking, well, I'm going to need a new first officer. Because this is a planet that's supposed to have, like, billions of inhabitants. They sent a starship out this way. Everyone's been wiped out. Am I alone in thinking that you probably shouldn't be sending people down? I mean, I know that you want to find out what happened to the Drake, but at this point I'm thinking, yeah, arms dealers, lots of integrated weapon systems. Let's kind of steer clear of this place.
Right. Because I wondered that too. I mean, why didn't we just like, well, there's nobody here. The Drake's not here. Let's just move on. You know, there's power sources down there. And I think Riker says, we have to go down there. Why?
Well, you never know. Maybe there's survivors barren, you know, way beneath the rocks, and they can't scan that deep. Who knows? It'd be a very short episode if they just up and left.
They could be. I mean, they could be all part of a computer program sleeping while a clown is torturing them. Who knows?
I thought Picard was staring at the turbo lift going, geez, why don't I get to go on away missions anymore? And obviously he fixes that problem real quick later on in the episode, but he kind of had that look of jealousy. Oh, he gets to go with Tasha Yar, and I'm stuck on the bridge with Worf and LaForge. So.
Really? Yeah, because I was thinking maybe Picard had the look of, so which one do I want to take to bed tonight? Tasha, Crusher, Troy? Or maybe it's, why is that door so filthy? Or maybe he couldn't remember if he left that pot of tea burning. So, anyway, but that's enough of that. Okay. So the Drake is investigating why all intelligent life on the planet disappeared. Do you think that maybe they were intelligent to design this weapon that killed themselves?
Not so much.
So maybe, you know...
I still think it's an interesting concept. You know, you see it a little later on in Deep Space Nine with the Ferengis, who are arms dealers. But this is, I like the concept that there's a planet here that you come to, and they'll sell you stuff, and it's different weapons, and obviously the weapons got out of hand. It's not like it was one of those weapons. I'm sure the whole planet just got, you know, inundated with all those different marks or different models of weapons, and it just wiped them out pretty quick. I like the concept that, you know, sometimes we have to be careful what we wish for and what we design.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, here's my captain's log. Captain's log. We're beaming to a planet that is devoid of life, but seems to have very few trees, mainly in the camera's view, but has plenty of rocks and fog. An away team is transporting to determine why intelligent life was eradicated on the planet, while the sound of birds chirping signals a continuation of their existence. So, why would there be birds on the planet still? I mean, if these machines were to wipe out all life, is it discriminating just a humanoid life?
I mean, by the way, having said that, right, if you were in the if you were in the market for weapons and you did go down to a planet to pick up some weapons that you could use in war, you wouldn't really want the weapons to be wasting their time knocking out the enemy's birds, right? Or, you know, various other animals. You'd probably want them focused on the soldiers.
You got me there. But what I really meant was, once all the people are gone, why didn't it continue on the birds? But okay. Yeah. Minos' claim to fame was being arms merchants for the I knew I was going to do it too.
Ursula, wasn't it?
Ursula Rope Wars. Okay. Well, anyway, I'm going to go on about that. Okay, so, you know, Geordi, you know, they were arms merchants for those wars, and Geordi asked for which sides, and we find out both. And I was thinking, huh, see? Admiral Jameson isn't the only one in the universe that thought giving weapons to both sides in a war would be a good thing to do. Mm-hmm.
What did you guys think of the salesman? I know we didn't really speak too much on that. What did you think about him?
But I mean, let me go first. I think the guy playing the salesman is pretty good, to be honest. I think he comes across exactly how you'd probably want to portray this kind of guy, this kind of slippery salesman. I think later on he has his interactions with Picard when they're on the surface. I think he does a good job there as well. Maybe it's even him that provided kind of like the main, you know, memory that I have of this episode when I first watched it, because I do very clearly remember the salesman, and I enjoyed his performance.
Yeah, me too, actually.
And you know how he mentioned, what is it, peace through superior firepower and right. Stuff. I think it's, you know, I think it's fun concept to be playing around with. I mean, as Blair mentioned, I think as a concept, I quite like this episode. We've said a lot that the stuff in season one is clunkily executed, and I think this episode does better than most. But you know, some of the concepts they seem to be wrestle with in season one, they're actually pretty good. Had it been more polished, I think it could have been off to a great start.
Mm-hmm. I thought the salesman was pretty funny. I loved his facial expressions. He was, all he cared about was just making the sale, right? And I really liked it. And I definitely think that this one was more polished than some of the other episodes that we've watched so far.
Yeah, he was absolutely funny. I love it when he was doing his piece through superior firepower. You know, at peace, he has his hand over his heart, and then he raises it to give the fist for superior firepower. And I would have liked to heard the rest of his speech or his sales pitch, but Picard cuts it off because we don't just build weapons; we build what did he say? Complete weapon system. And that's all we heard. And I would love to have heard. You know, he didn't talk terms, how much it was going to cost, or anything like that. And it's another thing. Why are these people on this planet all dead? Didn't one of them think about doing what Picard said? And we'll buy it. We'll buy it.
Oh, yeah. Whoa, spoilers there. Spoilers.
Anybody listening to us already knows this.
No. And I know that, I mean, I don't think it's necessary for you to believe that the episode, I know the episode suggests that everyone on the planet was killed by the weapon that they were looking at, but I don't think it's necessarily true. I think they could have been killed by other weapon systems and stuff like that. I think even to the point that it's not even made clear that it isn't the disgruntled customer that ends up wiping out the planet. It just happens that when the crew beam down, they end up triggering the weapon, you know, the weapon that the episode has, and then that nearly kills the crew. But I think it's still a little bit up in the air as to what actually killed the planet. And indeed, how large the planet would have been prior to them being wiped out. Are we talking about this being a planet that has millions of people on, or is this a kind of like a planet where people can demonstrate weapons, and it's more of a kind of like an outpost with several hundred people that they can, you know, they have a range where they can show the capability of the weapons?
A good point. We don't really see the remains of the Drake.
Nope.
Or maybe the planet that took the 37s, you know, abducted these people. Anyway.
Okay. But let me go ahead to, you know, when they go down to the planet, did anyone else think that Riker, when he was talking to the hologram of Captain Rice, was a bit Kirk-like in how he managed to argue a computer, you know, out of existence, or in this case, he argued a hologram out of existence?
Yeah.
Yep. I thought it was very, just even the look of the planet looked very TOS, you know, just kind of, yeah, any Riker was the cavalier type guy, and just the way he was standing definitely was reminiscent of Kirk.
And then when he gets caught within the little bit of a beam, you know, there is a small issue here with production values in that he gets frozen, and then Picard asks, you know, is he alive? And I think Data says unknown, but at the back of my mind I was thinking, but he is still moving, I can see.
You could see him moving?
Yeah, he was swaying a little bit.
Hold the phone. I gotta see this. As you know, I usually have the episode running or handy, so... You're right, he was swaying. That's a good observation. Wow. What do you think about Ensign Su? Oh, never mind. I'm not even going to go there. We'll lose our family appropriateness value to this one. Because do you remember when she was on DS9, the same girl?
Yes.
I don't remember.
No.
Really?
I don't remember this. Who was on DS9?
The girl who played Ensign Su.
Let me
find it here real quick.
No, I can get it. I didn't recognize the crew. I thought that they were all one-timers.
Yeah, Julia Nicholson. She plays on DS9 as Cassandra in the episode Paradise. But the thing is, what I was getting at is when she... I know these chairs on the bridge of the Enterprise D in first season are laid back to where you're almost laying down. And she looks... You know, massive in this one, but as Cassandra, I don't know. I just don't see the same look. But
it's the Starfleet uniforms.
It must be, because my goodness, I don't know what the seamstress had to go through to fit that. But it's a different story. Okay, all right. Here's a question for you guys. I can assume that the computer that built the probe to look like Rice understood that, you know, he's a captain, simulate the captain, but how did he know to call Riker by name as well as we were friends thing? I mean, it's not like this thing was probing people's minds, right?
I was wondering if maybe perhaps when the salesman first came onto the ship, that it was like a beacon that was scanning maybe the ship's database, and maybe they just didn't know that they were being scanned.
Well, even if that was the case, then he would know that Riker's first name was William. You know, the whole point of this is you don't know my name, do you?
True.
Because he didn't. So, I mean, how did the probe know that Riker and Rice were friends at any time? Okay, or maybe it was tapped into the ship's communications and heard Riker talk about Paul Rice. All right.
Yeah, they don't really get into. There's a few plot holes, I think, that you just kind of have to look past.
Yeah. So anyway, Rice, I should have known you'd pop up. How are you? Hey, remember when you schnogged Emily Sue Jones that night in our physiology class? Those were the days. You know, number one, there's something you should know. Low-level energy readings, but the only life signs are those of the away team. Oh, and I heard what you said about Emily Sue Jones, number one. No, I didn't do that. You look strange, Paul. What'd you think? Did Paul look strange? Maybe all the... I mean, he looked like he had some hard miles on his face.
Yeah. Yep. I guess when you're going warp 3 forever, you know, maybe you get a little frustrated. And those are hard miles.
Uh-huh. So for a little bit of fun, he sticks his head out the window and has space debris slap him in the face.
Yeah.
That could be. And, you know, do you think the lollipop ruse might have worked better if Data had anything of a poker face?
You are right. Data in particular, he should be easily able to keep a poker face, but he kind of comes on and he scans Rice, and then he kind of very clearly lets on that they're onto him, and he doesn't, you know, when he overhears the lollipop, it's like a ooh. I mean, I think Data's been pretty poor all season, but I think again he's not, you know, it's not particularly great Data at this point.
No, maybe that's the reason why Captain Picard felt he had to come down to the planet, because he didn't have any faith in Data's ability to get Riker out of the force field.
I mean, actually, at this point, when Picard decides to beam down, I'm surprised he does. I'm surprised that, you know, it's kind of thrown bad good money after bad, right?
Yeah,
you've got the first officer, the second officer, oh, throw down the captain and the chief medical officer while you're there. And
the security chief.
Why not? There are a lot of people down there that probably shouldn't be there, right?
Most of them shouldn't have been there. Okay.
Yeah, that was definitely the one factor that you really have to look past here. It was, I just shake my head. It was great because it gets LaForge in command of the ship, but yeah, really, that's... After that look at the when Riker first left the ship, you know, you would think he would be very concerned about what's going on down there, and that he should stay on the ship.
And actually, something that I think, I mean, Lou, we spoke about right at the beginning. I don't think we've had an opportunity for quite a while, but I think this is Yar getting back into like a good role. I think it's been quite a long time that Yar's been used properly. And I think this is, I mean, and ironically, it's so close to her disappearing. I think this is really the type of role that she should have been doing much more of.
Right.
I think she worked very well in this episode, but it just reminded me that we haven't really seen Yar, you know, take charge of a situation, take charge of an away team, a tactical situation on the planet. And, you know, she's really been marginalized up until this point.
Well, you know, like I said, Worf had to step up because she wasn't on the ship, and there was a previous episode where she wanted to beam down, but she couldn't because there's a possibility of the Romulans that were going to sneak up on us, so she had to stay on the ship, and Worf went down. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's... I'm convinced at this point they knew she was leaving. This wasn't a, hey, guys, I hate to bring this up today while we're filming, but this is my last episode. It couldn't have happened that way.
They know by now, because in the very next episode, it's the episode that was filmed last, where she kind of waves goodbye to the fans.
Right.
So we're very, very close to her leaving.
So I think they wanted to, you know, have her go out with a bang and give her something really substantial to do. So. Okay, so, Paul, what's my first name? You don't know it, because you're a fake. So now, I'm going to hide behind this tree and call you names. Yeah, so, oh, anyway. What's happening, number one? Report! Oh, man. So he's in some kind of energy field. The captain beams down, leaving LaForge in command. LaForge remain above. Now, where'd that come from?
I don't know.
Okay, how about if I do the real line? LaForge remain below. Stumped you both?
Yes. Yeah, stumped me.
The professor, Berlinghoff Rasmussen.
Yes, I know the episode, I just don't remember the line.
Yeah.
I don't remember the line either.
He was on the planet that they were trying to get the... CO2 concentration around to hold in the heat of the sun, and it didn't work, so they had another one that could cause an exothermic inversion or something like that, I remember. And that's when he made that comment of LaForge, remain below.
It's time for you to return to the ship, Miss LaForge. Mr. O'Brien, stand by to transport.
Excuse me, Captain, but I can be of a lot more help down here. We're going to have to compensate for the density variations right up to the last second.
Dr. Mosley's computers can accomplish the same task, sir, but I believe Geordi would be better able to anticipate unexpected variances.
Mr. LaForge, you know better than anyone that there's no guarantee that this will work. And if it fails...
There's no guarantee it's going to fail, Captain. I'd like your permission to remain here on the surface.
Permission granted.
LaForge remain below.
Good luck, Commander.
Thank you, Captain.
I just thought it'd be funny if I said LaForge remain above.
By the way, I've watched that episode recently as well.
Oh, yeah?
It's a good episode.
Oh, you know, I'm telling you, Doc, when we get to season 3... Yeah.
That episode's season 5.
Is it? Yeah, but I just think that it takes off big time when it goes to season 3, but go on.
No, indeed. Actually, the reason why I saw it, by the way, is because I happen to get the discs from season 5 in last week, and I thought, ooh, I'll have a quick look about how it stands up, and I happened to put on that one. I haven't gone. This is actually, by the way, this is tangent. This is a bit of a the bad thing about doing the podcast, right? Because had I not been doing the podcast, I might have thought I'm going to continue my TNG rewatch.
Yes.
Because I was rewatching it. I got to around season three. I think I got to, you know, towards the back end of season three. And then you said, well, let's do the podcast. And I have to start all over again. And I can't, you know, there's no point in me watching season six or getting through season four.
Right.
So I'm kind of having to hold back, right, on season five and six, and we're not going to get to that stuff for a couple of years.
You're right. You're absolutely
anyway,
right.
Well,
I'll even extend it. After I got done with the Arsenal of Freedom and Symbiosis is the next one, I started to watch Skin of Evil, and I said, no, stop, because I'm going to have to watch it again later and make notes. So, yes, you're right. I can't go on. Okay. So anyway, LaForge, your primary concern is the safety of my ship. Keep everyone alive, even Counselor Troi, even though she doesn't really want me to go. What do you think of... I can't think of his name, and I thought I had it here somewhere. The guy who keeps coming up to the bridge. Logan?
Lieutenant Logan.
Yes, the drop-in chief engineer of the day.
Yeah. I thought he was a bully, quite frankly. And if you notice, too, just the way the camera angles were, he's a much taller man than LaForge, and he was looking down on him. And I just got the impression he was definitely being a bully type thing. Hey, it's, you know, let me take charge. You're useless. You're incompetent. I can do this job better than you. And tried to bully LaForge into doing it.
No, and also, he kind of, like, for the first half of the episode, or you know, the first third or so, he sits there saying, you know, we should leave. And then LaForge says, we should leave. And he goes, well, you're going to leave them there. It's almost as if LaForge can't do anything right.
Right. You can't please a man. Okay. You just wanted us to leave, and I'm leaving, and you want to stay. I love that part. You know, I know we're jumping ahead a little, but, you know, Mr. Logan, you're going to take command. And you, the grin all of a sudden, wow,
yeah.
Of the saucer section. Ugh.
It's like really bursting his bubble there.
Yeah. I outrank you. Well, you know, there's an interesting part. That is true. The chief engineer would outrank him. So, okay. So if he outranks him, why is LaForge putting his foot down and saying, I'm in command?
Well, I always look at it, and I've heard this term used in the military quite often, don't confuse your rank with my appointment. And appointment outranks your rank, bottom line is. You know, you can be a captain of a ship as a lieutenant commander, but you're still the captain of the ship. It's still your ship.
That is true.
Even as a lieutenant commander. The way I also relate it to is you could have a colonel who's a chaplain in the military. He may outrank, you know, a major or whatnot. But and that major will call the chaplain sir, but make no bones about it, that major will be calling the shots because he is in the operational operational appointment. So that's kind of the way I look at it. So
this is when, you know, Picard and Crusher can like head down to the planet. And in my recollection of this show, it's the subplot that I always forget about. I always forget Picard and Crusher end up on the planet together, trapped. And I've actually got here that I actually think that, you know, at this point it's pretty clear that the show is pretty competently put together, and they've kind of interwoven the kind of, you know, the three storylines that are going on. So obviously we have LaForge up on the ship by himself. We've got a couple of people running away from the weapon on the surface, and you have Picard and Crusher down below. And I think that they all work pretty well, and they're quite nicely interwoven into the climax at the end.
Yeah, and it's interesting that she got all busted up, and Picard, he barely get a scrape.
Well, I think he must have landed on her.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Now, didn't Data say it was 11.75 meters or 11.25 meters? 11.75 meters. That's almost 38 feet.
Really?
And for Picard not to get hurt, you know, or not even a scratch, and Crusher only have a broken arm and something wrong with her leg, which we never really found out what that was. But maybe this is just the paramedic in me. But, you know, not to have, you know, spinal fractures, pelvic fractures, fractured legs, you know, did they land on their feet? They went head first. So yeah. I'm telling you, they probably landed on their backs. And I just wish maybe they had shown a little more of her injuries to really get the severity of it and, you know, have an open fractured leg. And they say her leg was bleeding. And yeah, I'd be more concerned about the internal bleeding into the pelvis area or your brain bleed at this point. But they were more concerned about, you know, splinting the arm and, you know, rubbing the ointment into her leg, you know, and then crane her neck up and lift her feet up and don't worry about spinal precautions. But, you know, that's just me having a hard time looking at that, cringing that if I ever found somebody fallen 38 feet onto a rock floor with a bit of dirt. Yeah.
Well, I think the only difference would be today you would get somebody falling 38 feet. You don't have a clue what you have on the inside, whereas they can open up the tricorder and tell what's where and what's wrong. And I got the impression she had internal injuries. Do you think it's just because of the blood loss in the leg that she was starting to fade off?
That's what they seem to be saying. Like she as a doctor should have said, hey, I've got internal injuries. I can't move my pelvis. Here's what I should be doing. Here's where I'm probably bleeding at right now. And you can't do anything about it. I don't even think Picard had a tricorder with him. I can't remember. I don't recall him ever. Like, I know I saw the tricorder fall into the hole with them because she threw them as she was falling. But did they land in the hole with them or did they go on the other side of the hole? But I don't recall Picard ever opening up a tricorder. We had to wait for Data to actually come down and open up.
I think you're right. Yes, because I think somewhere in my notes here was, you know, it's interesting that – oh, yeah, because Data opens up the tricorder, scans her, and then gives Picard a look of, oh, crap, she's screwed. And I thought, wait a second, is that a medical tricorder?
Yeah.
Or do you think the holographic doctors is being a jerk? But yeah, you're absolutely right. 38 feet, they did go head first. And, you know, the fact that she was buried in all that dirt or something.
Oh. Yeah, she should have been really out cold. And even still, Picard didn't have a single injury on him. And and the severity of those injuries, he really and truly, he should have been, okay, I'll stabilize you and get moving, trying to find a way out of here because you're in rough shape right now. But anyways, that's just me looking at it from a different perspective. When I was first saw it, I probably never thought anything of it. But
no tourniquet?
Yeah, exactly. So
you know, I mean, it's not like, yeah, you're right. Okay. So anyway, okay, here we go. So we go back to up above where Data's phaser is attempting to turn off the force field. Do you think it would have been a hoot if Riker was actually aware of what was going on? He just couldn't communicate that every time the phaser blast hit the bubble, it's, ouch, Data, stop it!
Well, I found it odd because when they release him, Data, or Tasha, I think, said, okay, we have to go find Captain Picard and Dr. Crusher, and Riker was like, okay. Wouldn't he be, what do you mean Captain Picard is down here? Why is he down here? Because he didn't know Captain Picard had come down. And he just doesn't make any, doesn't raise an eyebrow or get any concern that Captain Picard is on the planet at this point. He just goes along and follows them.
Right. Yeah. Ensign to away team, sensors indicate energy readings in your area. Yeah, thanks, Ensign Sua, but our tricorder should have picked up the same thing, shouldn't they?
Yep.
Okay. Well, anyway, so a happy-faced robot tries to destroy the away team and chases Picard down and Beverly down the hole. What'd you think of the robot? I mean, the probe, I guess you can call it. Did you kind of see a happy face in it?
No, I don't know why, but I kind of had a feeling that it was very like, you know, the War of the Worlds kind of ships. Oh. I kind of got that vibe from it, but maybe I'm wrong.
No, I agree. Yeah, kind of had that look. And...
Oh, okay. It also kind of looked like a power tool with the handle, You know, the tool on the top and the battery thing on the bottom.
The thing I liked about it, though, it was just simplistic. And the next model was the exact same. You know, and in a way, that's kind of good, because if I was fighting an enemy and they all looked the same, how would you even know? Was it a scout? Was it a heavy weapon? Was it a, you know, an information gatherer? You know, things like that. I'm sure it was done for budgetary reasons, but when you think about it, a weapon that looks exactly the same all the time, yeah, it's small, it's compact, it doesn't look threatening, but it, you know, it can pack a big punch.
Right.
And I have to say, I think that the design, and perhaps when I say the design, I'm not talking from an artistic point of view, but the design of this fake weapon where it kind of upgrades itself and improves on each iteration, I think that's actually, to be honest, I think that's pretty terrifying, right? And from the story perspective, it allows them a very nice thing where they can come up against a threat, they can destroy the threat, but at the same time when they do that, they're effectively given over information that will, you know, surely lead to their doom in 12 minutes time. And I think it's quite nice how they use this device to effectively set a ticking time bomb for the episode to climax in 12 minutes when the next version is released.
Do you see a reason why it has to upgrade itself after every encounter? Why not just go for the full upgraded version? It'd be over.
I guess if you figure, you know, the least amount of, you know, if you're against a bunch of people with sticks and spears and all that, you'd only need the basic version. So why waste the resources and that, I guess that's, or it got destroyed, but and it had a mission to carry out. Therefore, if it got destroyed, then they have to upgrade and you know, fix the problem so they can carry out its mission.
Right,
and I was kind of like under the impression, maybe it was erroneous, but I was under the impression that it was kind of like learning each time. So it wasn't necessary that they were sending out kind of like, you know, Mark 1, Mark 2, but they were sending out a version that then kind of like adapted and learned and then was able to kind of like implement this stuff. But maybe, you know, maybe I'm just reading too much into it. I did, by the way, like the name of the thing, which, unless I misheard it completely, it's Echo Papa?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
The Echo Papa 607?
Yes.
Yeah.
Echo
Papa. I mean, 607, fine. Echo Papa?
Isn't that military? EP?
Yeah, phonetic.
Yeah, I think it's E-Echo P-Papa. Or what is the military for P?
Papa.
Yeah, so there. I think that's probably why.
Mm-hmm.
But it's on an alien planet.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah. Well,
that's the universal translator there, then. But what do you guys think about when the weapon attacks Riker, Data, and Yar, hits the tree? And that's another thing. The weapon's always hitting trees. It doesn't hit the people. Hits the trees. And then Data tosses Tasha about, you know, 10 feet under what I think is under her head. Because when you watch her fall, my goodness, that had to hurt.
And she didn't. It was a very poor stunt double of Data, that's for sure.
It was.
Oh, they didn't even try to hide that. But
no. No, because, you know, yeah, you're right. I mean, the hairdo is way off, but I don't understand what was the I mean, I'm watching this frame by frame. She literally lands on her head. What was the purpose of tossing her like that?
And then leaving Riker.
Yeah.
It's all the action, just to make it look good and show his superior strength. And because he hasn't really done too much else in this episode, really.
No, he's just encased in a bubble. Where Data very obviously reports that it's to await interrogation. The close passbys of the weapons fire must have disrupted our communicators. You know, I think this might be one for research and development. How to counteract the close pass weapons fire effect on our communicators. Maybe it should have went through a couple more drawing boards before. And the close pass weapons affected our communicators. Good enough for me. Then why doesn't Picard's and Crusher's communicator work?
I blame it on the fall, the 38-foot fall.
Ah, yes. Broken leg, broken arm, broken communicator.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the reason why Picard survived is because he landed on her goodie bags.
Oh. Yeah.
She was the airbag for his fall. Okay. So, how about this for timing? You know, don't worry, Beth. When the Forge realizes he's lost contact with us, he'll beam us up. Meanwhile, on the ship, sir, I read all five members of the away team. Goody, transporter room, lock. Uh-oh, shield just came on. How's that for timing?
Mm-hmm.
But also, right, you're on a planet, you activate the weapon is demonstrating to you. Why is another weapon targeting the ship? I don't quite get, you know, that's a bit random, isn't it? I mean, you almost couldn't have had anyone else on the planet anywhere or a ship in orbit without these weapon systems coming after you. I mean, I suppose that's probably the moral of the story. But it seemed, to a certain extent, it was a way, I suppose, of getting the bridge, kind of, you know, getting the Enterprise kind of busy and away from things.
Let me see what you think about this, Doc. I don't think the salesperson or the sales script really meant anything. I think it was all a diversion, a ruse. I think that their whole goal was to destroy the people. Why, when he was able to make a cell, though, everything shut off, but except for the one that tried to destroy the Enterprise? But like you say, why was it even trying to destroy the Enterprise anyway?
I kind of looked at it as this, the whole sales package. You know, you come to, you're looking at go to buy a house. You got your salesperson, you know, he's showing you the outside. He's showing you the inside, the basement. And while you're doing that, maybe, you know, your wife or whatever is looking at the master bedroom, you know. So it's showing the complete package of here. We got our ground forces and we have our space designs as well. You know, and
yeah.
that's kind of the way I looked at it. It was a complete package, and it was trying to say, you know, we got our guys on the planet. We're going to show them the planet model, and we got our guys up in space, and we'll show them the space model. And obviously, there's something wrong with the design. That's the way I always looked at it. But it still doesn't explain once you bought the merchandise that the one in space didn't shut off.
Yeah. So you drive the family to the house to check out the new house. You leave the dogs in the car. You go into the house, and while you're in there, somebody's trying to kill someone in another room while the Humane Society is trying to take your dog away. Because
pretty much.
Yeah, it just makes no sense. Okay.
Now on that, I'm pretty sure that – I mean, maybe it's not the case, but are we sure that it was even meant to be this way around? Maybe this is something that got kind of like lost in editing. Because if you were just to have the Enterprise destroy the weapon first, then all of this kind of gets sorted out, right? You know, the Enterprise can destroy the weapon, and then the guys on the planet can find a way of buying their version of the weapon, and everything is good. So I don't know why they have to have it so that the ground solved their problem first, and then the Enterprise then had to shoot down their target when you think, well, I thought this was all over. You know, it's just a simple edit of having the Enterprise blow up their thing first could have solved this problem.
You know why I don't think so? Go ahead. I'm going to see what you come up with first, Blair.
Well, I was just going to say, I think it adds to the drama that, oh my, Picard now knows that LaForge is in a heated battle up above, and LaForge has to tell him to wait while he solves the problem, and Picard's left helpless while young LaForge saves the ship. Right. And that's kind of the way I looked at it. But maybe perhaps if it was done the other way around, it would have been a little easier to agree with, I guess, or understand.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, LaForge had to risk entering the atmosphere and destroying the ship to actually get the thing to appear. So if he had actually destroyed it first before everything on the planet had been done, then that would have, you know, the machine would have just dispatched an even better one against the ship. And how in the heck would it have ever combated that?
That's a good point. Never thought of it that way.
Yeah. Okay, so let's see. We already talked about the ship taking fire from an unknown object and getting the tar beat out of it. Logan shows up, and we already talked about Logan.
By the way, I have to say, I think Logan's my least favorite of the engineers of the week in season one. I think he's also the actor that plays him isn't the greatest actor in the world. I think he's a little bit wooden, and I'll say even for season one, he's a little bit wooden. But I do like the way that Watson. You know, I do think that it's good that he's there because he is someone that Geordi is able to play off against, and we're all on Geordi's side here. And as was mentioned, you know, a little while ago, there's the bit where after the first attempt to destroy the probe fails, then he gets brought up to the bridge, and you know, you kind of think that Geordi is going to give up command, but he goes for, you know, plan B.
Right, you're right. Before the commercial break, you think LaForge is about to lose it. I mean, he may have actually just wet himself. And, you know, Mr. Logan, report to the bridge! We go to commercial break and we come back. Logan comes up and he's completely pulled it together. And this is what's going to happen, Mr. Logan. So, yeah, it was an interesting bit there.
I also like the way that, you know, you've ended up with the crew full of, you know, juniors, effectively. Mm. So, you know, junior at Khan, at Ops, at Tactical. I suppose not, you know, he eventually becomes very senior. But, you know, these guys, it's certainly the B team, right? And I think that it's nice. Well, it's a bit of a convoluted way that they got every single member of the senior cast off the ship. But it does allow you to have a bit of, you know, it does allow you to shine through. Some guys, and they do acknowledge that these guys would be nervous and these guys would need a bit of encouragement. And I think in terms of character development, there's, you know, there's a fair bit there for Geordi.
I definitely like the fact that, you know, at first, LaForge is a likable guy. And a lot of those junior officers would like LaForge. And they probably think, oh, LaForge is a good guy. He's in command. This will be great. He'll be fine. And then when things start going wrong, you start seeing the panic. And you see all the people who are in the rear station start looking at LaForge and start losing confidence. And the two at Ops and the Con are starting to look back. And everyone's starting to panic a little bit. And now all of a sudden they're thinking, yeah, he may be a nice guy. But nice guy or not, we're starting to get our butts kicked here. And do we have the confidence in this guy? And I still liked his command style. He was still that friendly, you know what? He was helping people fix their issues and giving them advice and trying to make them feel comfortable. I really liked it. And I definitely, and I'm not sure if we'll talk about it shortly, but when Troy and LaForge have their little discussion in the ready room. I thought Troy was used quite effectively. It wasn't any of this, hey, I'm reading people's emotions. It was, she was doing what a counselor needs to do. I'm sensing stress. They aren't reacting properly. I really thought they used her well in this episode.
Right. You mentioned them as the B team, and I was thinking that's obviously the B plot of what's going on above and how to mentor these people when he's young enough on his own.
No, and actually the great thing about how they use Troy in this episode is that they use Troy very well, and also, I don't know if you noticed, but as kind of effectively acting captain, Geordi goes into the ready room and, you know, uses the ready room as his place. And it's, you know, I don't think you often see that. Like when people take over, you know, when Riker takes over or when Data is in the chair, you don't see him going into the ready room to, you know, to have a think about things. But in this episode, Geordi does. He heads off there and has a think about the situation, as he should. But then Troy comes in and starts speaking about, you know, she's feeling stress or whatever. And she doesn't come to him and say, look, these guys need your help. She instead mentions the circumstance. And it's almost as if she allows Geordi to reach the conclusion that he was going to reach anyway. Right. So it's very much that Troy's used as a way of bouncing ideas off. And she kind of guides him without basically coming in and telling him, you know, hey, that dude sitting at Ops is scared. Go and sort it out. He kind of nurtures Geordi, yeah, you know, through his command.
Yeah. And
I like that moment when he goes into the ready room, the music that's playing. He, you know, it's kind of like, to me, he looks at Picard's chair like, and I, you know, and I thought your job was easy. My God, what you have to go through. And he
wouldn't sit in the chair either.
No, because it's not my chair.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know,
I thought it was well done. It was a way for him to kind of get that breather and, you know, just go into the ready room. I liked it. I really thought it was well done.
Something that I keep coming back to with this episode is that I think a lot of stuff is done very, very competently.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of ahead of its time in terms of, you know, how they are positioning him. You talk about Geordi, he takes command, or he's forced to take the command. He then goes into the room. He does go into the room. He uses the room, and that's one good thing. But then he doesn't sit in the chair, and that's kind of like an extra level on top of it. And it to me, feels much further ahead of its time, because at this point in TNG, we're still very, very simplistic in how the storytelling is being done. And I think this is one of the I'll go as far as saying, you know, although I don't think this is the best episode of the season, it's certainly one of the most competently put together in how, you know, the characters are evolving and how they're managing the three separate storylines. And, you know, we haven't spoken about it too much, but I'm even a fan of the kind of the personal relationship that is clearly emerging on the emerging between Crusher and Picard at this point, and how they're getting along as well. And I think that, yeah, I can't describe this as anything other than, you know, a very well, competently put together episode.
And I really like, too, and I know we'll get to it shortly, but Deanna Troi wasn't on the battle bridge, and I like that. She didn't need to go on there. It would have just felt forced if she also came with them. You know, she probably stayed on the saucer section and went with the rest of the families and the rest of the crew, and I like that. It wasn't – she did her job, wasn't forced, and then she left and let LaForge get to his business.
Okay. Yeah, so anyway, we get a Mr. Logan, you're taking command of the saucer section. And then I wrote, well, what's a saucer section? And so I'll describe it. It's a little plate-shaped bowl that Data uses to feed Spot his milk. So go feed the cat, Mr. Logan. So anyway, all right. We pretty much have covered this. The Echo Papa 607, once unleashed, it destroys everyone and everything except birds. What else?
So, Lou, how fast can you get a phaser lock?
Yeah. Woo-wee! I don't know. How fast can you get a phaser lock?
And I also enjoy what I do enjoy the fact, I mean, we've kind of alluded to it, right? Well, not even alluded. It's been mentioned outright. I do like the solution on the planet of the problem. I do like how it's solved. It's kind of, you know, it's a very simplistic thing. When I was watching it the first time, and, you know, yeah, I would have was 10, 11 or so, I didn't see it as the obvious thing. You know, why didn't they do this from the start? It was kind of like, it was obvious. It was kind of like there in plain sight. I suppose it's slightly hidden because you don't have the salesman for, you know, the first half of when Picard and Crusher are in the cave. Yeah. But, you know, when they introduce it as a solution, I was actually quite, you know, I thought it was quite good. I thought that was a quite neat trick, and I didn't see it coming.
Really? Because I always thought it was a writer's block. You know, hey, guys, we need to figure out a way to make these things stop. How do you do it? I mean, they're pretty indestructible, and they're getting better and better to the point where there's no way you could stop them. It's alluded that an entire planet was destroyed by these things. How can we stop them? Why don't we just hit the off button? Can we do that? So, yeah. All right, well...
See, I look at it as it wasn't hitting the off button, because I have no doubt, you know, the Drake probably looked for things like that and tried to hit an off button. But turning the program off really wasn't the solution. It was buying the product was the solution. That ended the program. And I'm with James. I like the way they came up with the solution, and yeah, I thought it was pretty good. Simplistic, but you know what? It worked. You know, when you're under a lot of stress and you're trying to think of all the tactical solutions of ways to get out about it, yeah, you probably don't think of the simple things. You're so focused on all your training that this is just too easy of a solution that you probably would have skipped over it.
So then how come when, you know, Picard agreed to the purchase, when they tried to leave, the salesperson didn't get all mad that they reneged on the deal and set one of those Echo Papa 608s after the ship?
Well, I'm wondering if maybe in the program then then they come through with a real person to finalize all the documents. The salesperson is just the guy to sell you the stuff. Then you need the other guy to come collect the money. And since he's dead anyways, then...
Yeah, it makes sense. But they don't really stop the program, though. There's the thing. They don't really stop the program. So next people come along.
Yeah, that's true, too.
I mean, by the way, either that with the program, or they actually send an Echo Papa 607 to, you know, to collect the last 18 months of back payments on the weapon, and he kind of turns up during season 3.
Yes, that is so true. Yeah, like the gangster is trying to collect. Okay, so anyway, Picard returns to the ship and pretends to be angry with LaForge that had left the ship in one piece and demands that it be returned the same. So,
well, I know we skipped over it, but what did you guys think of seeing the saucer separation again? We saw it in season 1. We'll see it this time and only see it one more time, I guess, in the series.
The exact same motions as the first episode.
Pretty much.
Yeah. You know, the saucer section was still in warp, continued on warp, while the drive section spun around. Okay, we've already discussed that one.
I wish we'd seen it more in the series. I was watching it with my young children there the other day, and they've seen TNG countless, well, not countless number of times, but they've seen it before. But I guess I never thought to tell them that the Enterprise could split in two. So I knew it was coming, and I didn't say anything. And I was just watching their eyes while it was happening, and they're looking, and their eyes are getting wide as saucers, and they're looking over at me, thinking, "Oh my, this is cool! You didn't tell me this happened, Dad. This is amazing!" And they didn't even clue in it was a different bridge at first. My one daughter said, "Why is the bridge all dark?" You know, and when it happened, they said, "What just happened?" And I said, "Well, the families are going to safety. Now they're on the battle bridge." And they ate that up. They thought it was great. And I know when I was a kid, I always, first run was, oh, are they going to separate? Are they going to separate? And they never did, except in Best of Both Worlds, which is great. But, you know, the amount of times that they probably should have separated and didn't, it would have been nicer to see. But as a young kid watching this, I always wanted to see the battle bridge and always wanted to see them, you know, separate the ship and go into battle.
Wow, that's an interesting. Because I always wonder one thing. You mentioned how the lights go dark. Why is that? I mean, why, like on Voyager, when they went to red alert, the lights went out and everything turned red? What's the point? I mean, do you need people squinting, trying to look at consoles because the lights are off? I mean, what's the point of having lights on to begin with? Just so people can see, nobody trips, no one gets hurt. So why do they turn the lights down?
I always thought it was because it makes the consoles brighter and you're able to see your stuff better. You know, it's just like looking at your phone in the sunlight. You have to put your hand over to see it a little bit better. But if you're in the dark, your phone comes through, the screen on your phone comes through nice and easy. You don't have to squint. You can see quite easily. And that's kind of the way I always thought it was dim the lights and let the stuff that you need to see appear much brighter and easier to deal with.
Right. That makes absolute sense. You're right. I see it.
You see, if it's dark, you see, and, you know, and Riker's focused on the view screen, he's not going to be distracted when an ensign walks in front of him.
Oh, yes, he is.
A cute ensign, and he, like, follows her through.
Oh, yes, he is. Oh, yes, he is. Yeah, Riker has double vision. Yes.
And then it makes the explosions look much nicer, too, when the consoles blow up.
That's true. Yes, because they don't put on a 50-cent fuse.
Maybe that's, they turn down all of the lights just in case when they do blow, they don't blow as badly. So they try to limit the amount of power on the bridge because the bridge itself is, you know, it's pretty ropey electrically speaking. So they can like turn off all non-essential lights. Otherwise, the thing will be going up like a Christmas tree every single minute.
That's a good point, too. Schooled. Thank you. Okay, well, is there anything else? Because we definitely went here. You were talking about why we thought it would be 40 minutes, 45 minutes at the beginning. Now I think we're over an hour and a half to woofty.
Okay, one final thing. Uh-huh. And you did mention it, but the final, you know, the way that Picard tells Geordi to get his ship back into one piece, mm-hmm. I enjoy. I find that tickles me.
Yeah. Me too.
Right. Oh, and let me think here. LaForge's solution, we know, to go into the atmosphere. A little bit later, Sue announces, I mean, they just got back, okay? All is solved. The away team just got home. They just got back on the bridge. And Sue announces that sickbay reports Dr. Crusher is going to be fine. Like, okay, why did they tell Sue instead of Picard? And how does, I mean, do they really say Dr. Crusher is going to be fine?
Well, I was more concerned that they dropped the shields while still in the planet and beam the beam. The hull temperature was 3,000 degrees. They just dropped the shields and incinerated everyone on the ship.
Good job, LaForge.
You survived the battle, but just one little oversight.
Right. Yes. Okay. It's now time to give our final thoughts and ratings for this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. And since I said that, I'll go ahead and continue on. LaForge taking command was great. LaVar has the chops for acting, of course. One moment he can play a man who just about dude his pants, and the next moment he's in complete control. It's time to show what LaForge can do. Ooh-wee! Anyway, it was also fun to see what Worf can do. I thought Worf was excellent. You know, we really didn't discuss much about Worf's work in this episode, did we?
We didn't really have time.
I know. Well, we wasted a lot of time. That's what we do. Okay, well, don't worry, Lieutenant. You only have to go back to the back console for a couple more episodes, and then you're on, kid. The Echo Papa devices were really interesting. Why an entire planet of people were destroyed with no dead bodies anywhere, by the way, and the nuts in not one poor devil thought to just tell the automated salesperson, yes, we'll buy, leaving me alone, escapes me. The lack of dead bodies makes me wonder if the people simply escaped the planet, as if we mentioned. Mr. Logan couldn't be happy no matter what he's given, so I have to wonder, you know, would things have turned out differently had he taken command? I think the ship would have been destroyed. Although I don't have a lot of negatives about this episode, it seems kind of middle of the road. But I changed my mind a little bit as we talked. We stepped into the traditional cliche, and we have to dig ourselves out type of stuff. No Wesley anywhere to be seen. So that's worth an extra 0.5. So I'm going to give this a 3.5. What about you, Doc?
Okay, sure. Now, I really enjoyed this episode. As I've mentioned, it's one of the ones that I remember from first run. And also, as I've been mentioning, I think this episode is actually, you know, pretty competently put together. I think it's got a good story at its heart. I like the interwoven stories that take place. Two on the planet, and then one up on the ship. I think there's good character development for Geordi. I think there's good character development for Picard and Crusher that kind of gets a little bit paused, certainly because, you know, within three or four episodes we don't have Crusher anymore. I also think that you know, obviously by this point they would have known that Yar's leaving, but I think Yar does very well in this episode as well, and really is doing what she should have been doing from like day one. I think that Yar really got a bit of a short stick during the midpoint of midpoint of series one, which probably no doubt was one of the reasons why she tried to run away as fast as she can. I didn't see the ending coming. I enjoyed it. Maybe it's just memories of how I remember this as a child, but I've really got a soft spot for this episode. And I kind of rate this guy a 4 out of 5. Now, on to our guest. Blair, what do you think of this episode?
Well, as I said in the very beginning, I love this episode. It's one of my favorites it is my favorite from season one. Even when I started rewatching Star Trek to catch up on season one, I'd always heard about this one where LaForge was in command. So LaForge was always one of my favorite characters. He is still my favorite from him and Worf from TNG. And I really love the fact that he was in command of the ship, a young officer in command. He didn't have the confidence. He was not necessarily faking the confidence, but trying to, trying to look like he was confident in front of his fellow young officers. It had action. It had phasers. We get to see the ship separate. We get to see the battle bridge again. As you said, James, I think Tasha did a good job. This is what we should have seen from her from day one. Troy did a great job. It wasn't overboard this time. She said her stuff, and that was it. Overall, I really, really enjoyed this episode. I still think it loses a mark just because of Picard somehow engineering getting down to the planet. It was a little, yeah, whatever, that's fine. And them not really explaining why the ship in space didn't stop after they turned the program off or bought the program. So I'll rate this. I'm not sure if we can have 0.5s. I know you guys don't really like them. So I'll go 4 out of 5. I would like to give it a 4.5, but I'll stay 4 just to keep with your rating.
No problem. I just went 3.5.
Okay. Well, then I'll still give it a 4. It's still a season one episode that, you know, has its season one has a lot of issues alone, but I'll give it a 4.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Paula changed our rules on that. So, okay. Well, hey, Blair, thanks for coming on today. And if you could think of any season two episode that you would be interested in.
Sure. If Times Squared's not taken, I'll jump aboard that one.
Oh, Colin's got it.
Curses. All right. I'll look at the list and get back to you.
Yeah. And, you know, I encourage everyone, go to lewtrekshow.com. I haven't gotten with the TrekMate guys about whether I could put this page on the Battle Bridge page for TrekMate. So if we could figure out a way to do it, I'll do it. But otherwise, go to lewtrekshow.com. And at the top there is the season one and season two schedule. Take a look at what you want. Send an email on what you want. And you'll have the approximate. Those dates are approximate that they're recording. So,
on the next episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation,
set course to intersect with the freighter.
Split second rescue pulls survivors from a fiery disaster.
Do you think our visitors pose a threat?
I don't know.
Only to find bitter enemies battling over life-saving drugs. Now, their desperate feud becomes a deadly face-off.
It will take us to our planet and leave us there with our medicine, or this person dies.
On Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Okay, well, please join us again next week as we review Season 1, Episode 22, and that's Symbiosis. So once again, thanks for Blair for popping by, and I'm James from London.
I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm Blair from Ontario, Canada.
And good night, everybody.
See ya.
Good night.
It's not nighttime where you guys are, is it?
No, it's afternoon.
It's around 4 o'clock or...
You know, that's
4
a good,
for me.
Yeah, we always say good night or thanks for coming on tonight or something, but really, they could be listening to it in the morning. Welcome to your bathtub.
I listen on the train.
Usually
on the train.
Do you have a car?
Yeah, no, we have a. We've mentioned this before on the show, and that is that.